Aloha and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich, and to my right, Chris Vandercook. Good morning and hello to you.
Hello, Beth Ann, and according to the envelope just handed me, I'm Chris Vandercook.
You're alluding to what happened last night.
I am.
Well, you know, when you think about where all of that kerfuffle could have stopped.
Yeah.
Really, when you think about Warren Beatty.
There's a certain amount of human error involved, you think?
Well, to look at that and say, clearly, if it says Emma Stone, La La Land, this is not the answer to the best picture. And one wonders why he simply didn't stop it then and say, you know, I think that there's an issue here. One moment. You'll have to forgive me, but... And then it would have all been fine. You wouldn't have had all those people in the middle of their speeches and realizing that they didn't get it.
It's probably the effect of facing an audience of 2 billion, but who's to say, right?
That is true. Now, that might have had a simple conclusion, but what's not so simple is an issue we're going to talk about this morning, or rather, right now. The search for a new chancellor for UH Manoa recently came up dry. For the foreseeable future, System President David Lastner will continue to do both jobs. That has Representative Kaniela Ng wondering why there needs to be two positions and whether it wouldn't be better just to save over $400,000 in salary expense by permanently consolidating them. Representative Ng says he's drafting a resolution to that end. Before the weekend, I spoke with David Lastner, and he seemed enthused about the prospect of starting a meaningful conversation with lawmakers about why UH Manoa needs the separate positions. First, though, we talked about why the chancellor search failed. In not finding a candidate, there can be lots of reasons. You just don't have a whole lot of candidates looking for jobs. You might have some who are in a current position who might be persuaded to leave if money and benefits pencil out. And, of course, there's the issue of timing with all of this. Did you find any evidence to point to one of these or another that might have predominated in the current search?
No, we didn't. We didn't do a detailed diagnosis, but we executed the search on our standard method, which is pretty common with universities around the country. We advertised widely, locally, and nationally. We had a pretty good pool of over 30 candidates. Our search advisory committee was highly representative and diverse. All the written materials that were submitted, they selected a set of semifinalists who were interviewed by Skype, and then we brought 3 finalists in to meet the university community and to be interviewed essentially by students, by faculty, by researchers, by fellow administrators. And at the end of the day, we were unable to make an offer that was able to be accepted.
Were there reasons that the finalists gave you for not being able to accept the offer?
There's nothing I would disclose publicly.
Okay, I can understand that. You've said, though, that these two jobs, yours and the chancellor's, are distinctly different and should remain separate. How would you define that distinct difference?
Well, let me say a little bit of background about how we came to that conclusion, because the University of Hawaii has actually functioned under both approaches, certainly during the last 30 to 40 years. We had the two positions separate through the early 1980s. They were combined through 2001, and then they were separated again in 2001. So it's not as if one answer is correct and the other is incorrect, but we try to find the structure that's best for a point in time. When the Regents raised this question a few years ago, we commissioned the Western Interstate Commission on Higher Education, WICHE, to come in and give us an impartial review, analysis, and recommendation. So they studied our history. They looked at other systems of public higher education around the country. They came to Hawaii and interviewed people on campus, faculty, administrators. They talked with people who had historically been involved in different models here in Hawaii. And their recommendation to the Board of Regents, which was embraced by the board as a whole, was that these are two separate positions and should remain so.
So can you detail a little bit of the differences between what you do and what a chancellor would do, something that led them to come to this conclusion?
Sure. So the way to think about this is the president of the UH system has a responsibility to a statewide agenda and to make all the parts of the UH system work together as seamlessly as possible for the entire state of Hawaii and our students, who interact with multiple campuses of the UH system. So there are a range of activities that are statewide in scope that have more of an external focus on behalf of the entire system, addressing the higher education needs of the entire state. A chancellor of a campus is responsible for the academic success and mission of that campus. So the faculty, the departments, tenure and promotion decisions, the internal structure of the campus, and the budgeting of the campus itself. The Witchie Report pointed out that depending on scale, administrative services can be provided either centrally or at a campus level.
So now as you are in the position of having to do both, because clearly you don't have someone who you've identified as a successful candidate, if you continue to do this well, does that bear out what Kaniella Ng is saying about the positions?
Well, I haven't talked with Representative Ng yet about his resolution. I did read about it, and if it's heard, we'll certainly respond and discuss it with them, and we'll share the report from Witchie, which lays out those reasons. Again, it's not that one structure is impossible to make work, but that the recommendation, and this is the Board of Regents is standing on this and I'm standing on it, is that right now, if we can separate those two positions, that would be optimal for the University of Hawaii at this time.
And of course, that's all dependent upon whether or not you can find someone who can actually do the job that you want to do the job.
That's right. That's right. So yesterday, the Board of Regents approved a resolution recommending that I continue as interim chancellor for 2 years. We have identified a set of tasks within the campus and with the board that are high priorities. It is my belief that we can make substantial progress on those matters over this two-year period, and I think we'll be very well positioned to attract a great chancellor to UH Manoa, our fabulous research university.
Meanwhile, Representative Ng is continuing to draft his resolution, which you mentioned you haven't seen or you haven't talked to him about. If this, in fact, goes forward, it's still a resolution, which means that, you know, it doesn't have the kind of bite to it that legislation might have. Are you at all concerned about this whole episode of going through and looking at this
way? Absolutely not. I mean, it is, you know, entirely appropriate for the legislature as a body to decide they want the university to take another look at something like this. We would, you know, respond to such a resolution. Our practice, like most of government, is that if a resolution passes both chambers, we take it seriously as an expression of the will of the legislature, and we would certainly be responsive, and depending on exactly what is asked for, we would be willing to talk with him about it. Certainly during the legislative session, this is something we would talk about with him and the legislature to share with them the work that was quite recently done that led us to the conclusion to keep the two positions separate. But there's no, you know, we don't feel badly or disrespected or angered by a resolution like this. It's all fair game to consider what's the best structure for Hawaii's public system of higher education.
You mentioned earlier that at least Kaniella Ng hadn't seen the Witchie report.
I don't know that. Actually.
Okay. But if he has not, and if other lawmakers have also not seen it, then, you know, shouldn't they see that first before we start talking about resolutions?
You know, a resolution is an invitation to a conversation. So certainly, you know, we will share that report with them so he can get a sense of it, and that might hone. He may or may not agree with it. The vote by the Board of Regents was not unanimous on this matter. So as I mentioned at the outset, you know, wise and committed people can see an issue like this in different ways. And clearly the university has functioned with both structures over the past decade.
Thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate the time.
Okay. Thank you very much, Bethann.
David Lastner is president of the entire University of Hawaii system. He is also the acting chancellor of UH Manoa.
This is The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, an innovative approach to mosquito control. But first, your quiz.
In today's backyard quiz, we're thinking about a local marine invertebrate that can be a ferocious predator. Its chosen prey is the sea star, which it pounces on, flips over, and devours alive. These creatures are popular species in aquariums, celebrated for their bright colorations, and despite their predatory nature, they're unusually slow-moving for their species. One writer said, quote, they are best described as underwater rhinos with their slow gait, but at the first sign of a meal, they'll spring into action, end quote. They're about 2 inches long when fully grown, with two pincers that fan out when extended and banded legs. The Hawaii species, Hymenoceria picta, has a white and cream-colored body covered with large red wine spots. Its name derives from one of the stock characters in Italian Commedia dell'arte theater. That's the name we're looking for. If you know it, call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. And if you're first, you get the prize.
Aloha, I'm William Finnegan from the New Yorker magazine. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
There are very few native birds left in Hawaii. Their populations have fallen prey to any number of threats to their survival. Today, about 24 species of Hawaii's remaining native birds are threatened or on the brink of extinction. One of the worst threats comes from mosquitoes as carriers of avian malaria and avian pox. Mosquitoes are notoriously hard to eradicate, though, and pesticide-based methods can cause as many problems as they solve. Cynthia King is an entomologist with the Department of Land and Natural Resources, Department of Forestry and Wildlife, who's at work on a much safer approach, the incompatible insect technique, and she's in our studio to tell us about it. Good morning, Cynthia.
Good morning. Thanks for coming in.
So, pesticides have been are as problematical as you might expect in dealing with something like mosquitoes, right? It's very hard to target a specific population that you want to get rid of.
It's true that that pesticides can have some non-target effects. Mm-hmm. And right now, they are relied upon pretty heavily when control needs to be implemented. And we definitely want them as a tool in our toolbox. It is
sure.
Very important.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, in the event that we could move away to a more landscape scale approach to mosquito control, I think that a lot of folks would find that there are a lot of benefits, ecological and health benefits.
And this is a pretty interesting approach because it might at first blush look like the introduction of a different species of mosquito, but that isn't the case. You're targeting a specific species with members of that same species.
That's right. So incompatible insect technique in this case would be targeted at Culex mosquitoes, and that's the mosquito in Hawaii that vectors avian malaria and avian pox.
Mm-hmm.
And really what we would be doing is taking mosquitoes from the wild population, essentially. What we're doing right now is funding research at the University of Hawaii to do this work. So mm-hmm. there are dedicated researchers at University of Hawaii at Manoa and University of Hawaii at Hilo taking these steps with these methodologies right now to essentially take those mosquitoes from wild populations, clear them using an antibiotic, and then infect them with another strain of the exact same bacteria that is naturally occurring in populations. That bacteria is called Wolbachia. And what happens is that means that the lab mosquitoes that have been infected with additional bacteria cannot mate successfully mm-hmm. with the wild type populations.
Because these mosquitoes, like many other creatures, have bacteria within them, just as humans do.
That's right.
That aid in digestion and things like that.
Exactly. So in mosquitoes, there are a wide variety of bacteria that can be found. Wolbachia specifically that we're talking about in this instance is present in about 60% of all insect species out there, mm-hmm. and mosquitoes carry it. And research that's already been done by USGS researchers here in Hawaii has shown that Culex mosquitoes carry just two different strains of the Wolbachia bacteria in the populations that are here. Mm-hmm. And so really all we would need to do is introduce to them a third type that would prevent them essentially from being able to reproduce with mm-hmm. the wild type mosquito. So it doesn't involve any other manipulation. It's the exact same species with bacteria that are actually already occurring here in Hawaii as well. But it can achieve this mosquito birth control, this incompatibility. And it's really important to point out that, you know, these mosquitoes, if you gave both male and females of the same species the same bacteria, they would still actually be able to mate. So the goal is just to give them a different bacteria so that they can't mate with the wild type mosquitoes successfully.
But the ones that you have harvested from the wild and then bred in the lab, they're not sterile. They can breed with their own kind that have the same bacteria inside them. They just can't breed with the wild mosquitoes. So you breed them in the lab, reintroduce them, and then that brings the mosquito population down.
That is how the technique works. And mm-hmm. I just want to be really clear that right now, one of the reasons that we did the press release last week and wanted to talk about this exciting project is because right now it is just in the laboratory stage, but we wanted to make sure the public was aware that this is a methodology that we hope can be employed in the future and has the potential of saving our Hawaiian forest birds, which are really teetering on the brink of extinction. At this point, it's really just in the lab. So the researchers at University of Hawaii at Manoa and University of Hawaii at Hilo are just in the process of having the cultures of those wild-type mosquitoes that they brought in, clearing them with the antibiotics, mm-hmm. and they will be infecting them with the additional strains of the same bacteria that they typically carry, and then do those tests to make sure that they are incompatible. And ultimately, that's what we're looking at right now at this phase of the project.
Because the science makes a lot of sense.
It does. And, you know, this science is actually being not just researched but applied all over the world right now. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of very successful projects that have already implemented this. The Eliminate Dengue program is currently on the ground and active in Australia and Brazil, Colombia, Indonesia. Mm-hmm. I think they're just starting a new project in India. And they're actually looking at Wolbachia in that case as a way of changing vector competence, which means that they actually, by introducing the same a different bacteria, but in the same manner that we're talking about, they can affect the mosquito's ability to transmit diseases. In this case, dengue fever is what they've been targeting for public health. But the other way that Wolbachia can be used is to do this incompatible insect technique, mm-hmm. where what you're doing is really trying to drive those populations down for really successful landscape scale control, just drop those mosquito populations. And the thing about it is it is something that has to be applied or conducted again and again in the event that we were going to move toward any field operations. What they've shown in other areas is that you need to do this successively to achieve control. Mm-hmm. And I should mention that it actually is already being done in the United States as well, to that incompatible insect technique to achieve population control. It's being done with a different species of mosquito, one that's of public health concern, Aedes albopictus. But those mosquitoes have actually already been released in Los Angeles, Kentucky, and I believe trials are going on in Florida and New York as well right now.
So there's every reason to anticipate success, Cynthia.
Absolutely, and that's one of the reasons that we're so hopeful that this technique could possibly, stop the extinctions, at least at the pace that they're currently progressing.
Let's hope so. Thanks so much. Cynthia King is an entomologist with the DLNR Department of Forestry and Wildlife. She manages the Hawaii Invertebrate Program and works on projects relating to insect pest species that have significant ecosystem impacts.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Tory Richard Limited, celebrating more than 60 years of design for the island lifestyle. Tory Richard is proud to support local community news, public affairs, and talk programming on HPR.
Washington has rarely been an easy town. Now with Republican control, a visit by a Democrat to make the case for a faraway island state got a little tougher. For Hawaii's Governor Ige, making the trip to the winter meeting of the National Association of Governors was a matter of practicality. Civil Beat reporter Kirsten Downey is on the line from Washington with a reality check. Hi there.
Good. Hi. How are you?
Doing okay, thanks. Looking at how one has to change mindset a little bit as you're walking into a group that's not perhaps going to be terribly friendly to your cause, especially given the polarization of parties, that's got to be difficult. What did Governor Ige tell you was his strategy going into this meeting in Washington?
Well, of course, you know, for Hawaii, this is an unprecedentedly difficult time because we are such a democratic state, but we have to interact with what has become an overwhelmingly a Republican government. The President, the House of Representatives, and the Senate are all controlled by Republicans. And on the governor level as well, 33 of the 50 governors are Republican. Only 16 are Democrat and one independent. So what Ige found coming here, what Hawaii's politicians definitely experience, is they have to find a way to bridge a divide that regular people are having a harder and harder time crossing themselves.
We expect our elected officials, though, to do that for us. The big question has been for quite a while now, how will Hawaii's congressional delegation, how will Hawaii's governor be able to advocate successfully for Hawaii if you have others who simply don't want to hear some of the message?
Well, it's a real dilemma. And for the politicians, it's a problem because part of their base right now is so angry that all they want to do is see them publicly fight. Much of the rest of the base, however, just wants to see elected leaders govern and get the work done for the people. Governor Ige came to Washington this week and decided that his focus and his choice would be doing the best he could for Hawaii's people in a difficult situation. So we had to try to, you know, get on the phone and start, you know, begging for interviews with cabinet officers.
Who was he able to see?
He managed to see Scott Pruitt, which is really interesting, one of the most controversial of Trump's appointments. He was a former Oklahoma attorney general who really led the fight against a lot of President Obama's environmental initiatives. Now he's head of the Environmental Protection Agency. But the EPA has a lot of initiatives in Hawaii and things that they do in combination with the states. And as difficult as the differences might be, Governor Ige came and tried to find ways to find common ground. He was pleased, at least, that Pruitt had visited Hawaii and understood our unique environment and had admired the beauty of the islands. And Ige took some comfort from that he'll understand we have a particular...
Forgive me for interrupting you for a second. We got to go here in just a second. But did he also have a chance to meet with Transportation Secretary Elaine Chao? Because that's obviously a very big thing for us, too, whether or not we're going to be able to continue on with rail.
Yes. Well, that is undecided yet. Nobody knows about the rail yet. But what Transportation Secretary Chao was willing to talk about is she clearly is supportive of a of infrastructure spending, which bodes well for a lot of projects, which means roads and bridges. And she's also very supportive of the idea of self-driving cars, which is technological innovation that Governor Ige thinks could bring jobs to Hawaii.
All right. I wish we had more time to talk, but we will hopefully in future. Thanks, Kirsten. Good to talk to you.
Thank you so much.
Every day we bring you a reality check from Civil Beat, today featuring D.C. reporter Kirsten Downey. In an equation, if you change the variable, you change the outcome. Recently revamped expectations of returns on monies invested for the state's pension fund substantially widened the gap to fully fund those liabilities. In short, the employee retirement system is now short, at least some $3 billion. And those aren't the only liabilities Hawaii carries for its past employees. Hawaii also isn't the only state set up for an unsustainable future, according to Stephen Greenhut. He's the Western Region Director for R Street Institute, a D.C.-based free market think tank, and he's in Hawaii this week and in our studio now. Good morning.
Good morning.
When you look at how all of this came about, this idea that there should be a certain amount in the calculation that would be a reasonable return, how reasonable is a return like, 8%, 7.5%, even 7%?
Well, it's not reasonable at all. I mean, any of us who had that kind of rate of return available to us would just put our money in there. But we can't. It's a political formula. And the unions and the government officials who benefit from it have the system going. And we see a 54% rate of return, a 54% funding shows that the rate of return is much too high. And what needs to be done is a more realistic rate of return, or a movement more to a 401k style retirement. The problem is the retirement benefits are far too generous, and taxpayers are going to be footing the bill, not just the extra $385 million a year for now. We're going to be putting up with reductions in public services.
You say we because you come from California. You're based in Sacramento. And California has been going through and slogging through this entire issue, too.
Right. And the talks I'm going to give, or I've been giving this this weekend, a warning that, California were much more far down the line than you folks in Hawaii with the pension spiking gimmicks and the massive retirements. I mean, we have, 3% at 50, which means that police and fire can retire with their full pay for the rest of their life and the rest of their spouse's life. And it just goes on and on, and politicians don't want to deal with it. The unions that represent these groups are very powerful, so there's no appetite at all for any of the kind of reforms. And we have all sorts of pension spiking gimmicks. And what you end up with is the taxpayers are backing these systems.
Across the country, there are only three states. I know Oregon is one of them. I think Wisconsin's another, that are able to fully fund their pensions. Everybody else is dealing with this to a greater or lesser extent. What did these other states do right?
Well, in Wisconsin, they had a very big battle. I mean, we saw that at the state capitol a few years ago. They had a governor who was willing to take on the unions directly. The unions fought back. They had a huge political brawl. Really, it was a brawl up at the capitol. I used to go over to Madison. You have to be willing to take on the unions. What needs to be done is the pensions need to be reduced going forward. You don't take anything away from people up till today. I had that happen to me at a place I worked where I had a defined benefit, which is the kind that the public employees have, where you're promised an amount based on a formula. Starting tomorrow, you have to start earning a lower amount. And what's needed are fundamental reforms that reduce the amount of pensions going forward. In Hawaii, you've got some of the lowest earnings in the private sector, and the government sector is growing, and it's just not sustainable, and it's increasing income inequality, and it's harming the kind of public services, education. We've had, in California, we've had cities that have gone bankrupt. And what happens is they end up cutting the number of police and fire. They end up cutting parks and recreation, and you end up with higher taxes. Even if the tax isn't directly a pension tax, everything in essence is a pension tax when you're that poorly funded.
So you have higher taxes and lower services is the point that you're making if you get to that point and allow it to continue along. This year being a pivotal year because we have collective bargaining and arbitration awards that aren't even appropriated yet. But for this to move into a position where we could begin to see some light at the end of the tunnel, what has to happen in the very near term as you look at our situation relative to yours in California?
Well, we're still dealing with unrealistic rates of return. And the way the pension formulas are calculated, the investment funds, they invest the money and they're guessing at a rate of return into the future.
But we all know that if you go talk to your own financial advisor, nobody is going to tell you to expect 7.5%, 8%, even 6%. They even tell you that once you retire, you've got to look at taking out maybe 4% of your nest egg if you want that money to last.
Exactly.
How do you convert that same type of individual financial planning into what has been happening at a state level?
Right. The problem at the state level is that the taxpayers are backing it. So the politicians can come up with a number, or the investment boards can come up with a number that really isn't sustainable. And we the taxpayers, have to back that. So that's the problem. It's too aggressive of a rate of return. And that's because the pension funds, the pension promises are just too generous. And in California, I mean, we see all sorts of pension spiking gimmicks. We see people.
Such as what? What's a pension spiking gimmick?
Well, at the last year or the last 3 years, now we average over the last 3 years, you get extra pay for different things. And managers get special management pay.
This is while you're working full time.
Well, that's right. And so it's just ridiculous. We have a list of 99 pension spiking gimmicks, things that you can enhance your last year's pay. We have people who move to a different area that's cost of living adjusted just for the last year of their careers, and that inflates their pension for the rest of their lives. We have these disability pensions. We call it chief's disease in California. I think the Sacramento Bee came up with that term. Virtually every police chief has some sort of disability, and that protects 50% of their income from taxation.
Now look back over the water at Hawaii and what you've been talking about during this week that you've been here. What's the absolute first point that you think we have to be willing to talk about and do something about to not follow California's lead?
Well, You have to look at those things, at the spiking gimmicks and the disabilities, and all these things add to the burden. But you have to look at the basic formulas and how much you're paying public employees. And the problem is the nature of the defined benefit, where you're promised an amount of benefit, and that's legally defendable. It's like a property right, so you can't reduce anything going backward. So you're going to have to look at the formulas and try to reduce the formulas going forward. And it's really unfair when you consider what does the average Hawaiian earn in retirement. It's nowhere near what the public employees. It used to be the deal was you would get a higher salary as a public employee. I mean, a lower salary as a public employee, but somewhat better benefits. Now, as the Grassroot Institute showed, that Hawaii's county workers earn among the highest in the nation. So now public employees get a higher amount of salary, and then their pension benefits are far beyond what people in the private sector earn. And a lot of times the unions will say, well, the average pension is only like 30-some thousand, but that's average. The average pension for a private sector employee is well under $10,000. So it's an imbalance. You have to look at how much you're actually paying and what these formulas are.
Stephen Greenhut, thank you so much for coming in.
Yep, thank
Good
you.
To talk to you. Stephen Greenhut is the Western Region Director for the R Street Institute, a D.C.-based think tank, although he is based in Sacramento. His most recent book about public employee issues is called Plunder. Stephen Greenhut is speaking tonight at the Grassroots Institute event in Honolulu. The event sold out, but we understand it will be recorded and the full video will be available online.
Aloha, this is Colin Moore, director of the UH Public Policy Center. You're tuned to Hawaii Public Radio. Join the conversation on Twitter. Talk back to your radio at HI Conversation.
Stargazer Time, our weekly look into the massive universe around our ridiculously small planet, plus what to look for in our dark island skies. And as usual, we tap into the considerable expertise of Christopher Phillips. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What's on the table this week?
Hey, Dave, it's good to be here. For this week's Stargazers, look out for the planet Venus in our evening skies just after sunset. It will be towards the southwest and will be incredibly bright. The moon this week will be a waxing crescent, becoming brighter as we approach the weekend.
And this week, I understand you want to take a deeper look at a recent discovery of a number of exoplanets and add a little bit of context to that.
Indeed. The announcement last week by NASA of the discovery of not one but seven planets, a mere 39 light years from the Earth, has caused an enormous wave of excitement to sweep across the globe. This discovery in the TRAPPIST-1 system has got both scientists and the public talking about Earth-like worlds. And rightfully, we should be excited, but we should also curb our enthusiasm a little bit.
Am I reading into that, that you're thinking there's not a whole Star Wars-like society over there that's just waiting for us?
You're absolutely right. The NASA Public Relations Office has really poured on the Earth-like aspect of these planets. These planets are currently estimated to be roughly the same size and mass as the Earth, but that's where the similarities end. Every other aspect of these worlds is distinctly alien.
I'm frightened to ask, what makes them alien?
Well, these worlds are all very close together and huddled in around their host star. That means we could have worlds that are tidally locked, meaning one side of the planet always faces the sun and the other is always in the dark. It also means radiation and a lot of it coming from the star. Also, 1 year on many of these worlds is just a mere 8 or 9 days long. That means that if they have seasons, you could see spring, summer, autumn, and winter all in the space of a week.
Got to bring a lot of different kinds of clothes with you, huh, Christopher?
Dress for every season.
And so it might be kind of a stretch to think they've got atmospheres.
It is indeed. Just because a planet is in the habitable zone of a star does not mean it's a nice, cozy place like the Earth. Take Mars, for example, in our own solar system. It has hardly an atmosphere to speak of.
But if you were a pair of droids like C-3PO and R2-D2, no problem living there, right?
It really wouldn't matter. Yeah.
It's Christopher Phillips and a very fun and enlightening Stargazer this week. Thank you.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. We'll catch you next week for another Stargazer.
Support for Stargazer comes from Urgent Care Hawaii, walk-in clinics in Pearl City, Kailua, Kapolei, and Waikiki, providing employers with occupational medicine and workers' compensation services. Letter UCareHI.com.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we told you about a species of shrimp that lives in Hawaiian waters and feeds on sea stars, our starfish. Its bright colors in their unique pattern make it a popular aquarium item, even though it can be costly to feed. It likes to feed on prey that's still alive. A pair can spend a week feeding on a single victim, and aquarium owners need to keep a ready supply of live sea stars on hand. It's their spectacular appearance that gives these critters their value to collectors. They're often described as looking more like an orchid than a sea creature. That's because their bright red spots on a white or cream-colored background, long antennae, and leaf-like pincers make them look sort of like a slow-moving flower. Inevitably, its colors remind observers of the colorful clown that's a stock character in Italian commedia dell'arte plays. That's why it's called the Harlequin Shrimp.
And John Sandbach from Kihei knew the answer, called us quickly, and is the recipient, or will be, of our prize.
All right.
If you've got a backyard quiz for us, you can always send it in to us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We'll have a look at it, and if it's a good one, you just might hear it on a future show.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000, a literacy program used by Hawaii students in grades 2 through 12, offering home edition with parent support in 19 languages. Achieve3000.com.
We'll never stop dreaming of life on other planets, but we've been discouraged by what science has been telling us for years, that the conditions that allow for life on Earth are rarely, if ever, found anywhere in the universe. Last week's announcement that seven so-called exoplanets, theoretically capable of supporting life, have been discovered a mere 40 light-years away has reopened the discussion and excited astronomers around the world. This is the first time multiple Earth-sized planets have been found orbiting the same star. Christoph Baranek is a faculty member with the University of Hawaii's Institute for Astronomy with a focus on exoplanets. He's on the line to help us sort out what this latest discovery means. Good morning, Christoph.
Good morning.
You know, we just heard on Dave Lawrence's Stargazer report that it's a little too early to get excited about this, but it seems pretty exciting, though, isn't it?
Oh, I and many of my colleagues are fantastically excited about this particular discovery, and not just because of the potential for life on these particular planets, but just the fact that, you know, we're now just starting to scratch the surface and looking for these types of systems. There are many, many, many orders of magnitude more planets that are out there that are going to be like this and that will be much more habitable towards life.
40 light years is well within the range of what we're able to observe, right?
Oh, easily. And we can, most of our ground and space-based facilities can look out at stars that are much farther away and find planets as well.
Well, given that, Christoph, why did it take so long to find this particular set of exoplanets?
Well, I think we've only just started using this new method called the transit method the past decade, and it's kind of getting more popular as time goes on in order to discover exoplanets. And one of the big missions that NASA put up several years ago that you may have heard of is the Kepler mission.
Sure.
And that observed a particular field in the sky for about 4 years continuously, and it's discovered over 4,000 exoplanets already. But Kepler was just looking in one particular part of the sky, so it took other people looking nearby with other facilities to actually find these other nearby exoplanets.
This is probably a pretty good time for me to ask, what's an exoplanet?
Oh, so an exoplanet is generally what we consider to be a planet, except not orbiting our star, but actually another star either in the galaxy or in the universe. So we just make that distinction because Earth, Mercury, Venus, Mars, et cetera, are all planets orbiting around the sun. Exoplanets are those planets that are orbiting around other stars.
So it's the same thing, except the planets are ours in our solar system.
Correct, right. So we have this sort of special definition for our own system, and that we call these planets, whereas ones around other stars are exoplanets.
Christoph, when we talk about the conditions that support life, what are we talking about? What's necessary?
Well, the technical answer to that is we don't really know, because there are many, there's possible forms of life that don't exist with the same chemistry that we have here on Earth. But, you know, just kind of being naive, what we tend to assume is that in order for life to exist that's similar to ours, that we need things like liquid water, we need other sort of carbon molecule and carbon-based molecules that could potentially support life.
But that really doesn't rule out the possibility that there's a whole broader definition of life.
Absolutely, right. And, you know, that's not something that we typically as astronomers we get into. So we're just starting with sort of a simple framework that we, at least we can work with for now. And until the biologists kind of help us understand how other forms of life can evolve, we're kind of sticking at the moment to a definition of life needing, like, liquid water, for example.
Well, you know, Christoph, I'm sure you've run into this all the time, the whole idea of science imitating science fiction as opposed to the other way around, you know, where frequently science fiction writers, I'm thinking Arthur C. Clarke, Isaac Asimov, anticipate discoveries that are made later.
This is absolutely, this is kind of mind-blowing for myself, and I'm sure a lot of the listeners out there. I mean, I grew up with Star Wars and Star Trek, and mm-hmm. I just, you know, when I was a little child, I actually just assumed that there were lots of these exoplanets out there. And then, you know, as I've grown up, I've discovered, oh, they're not really there. But then, you know, just in the recent past, you know, we're suddenly finding that, hey, all this stuff is actually real. It's really helped shape my view of the world.
But kind of that's got to sort of take you back to that initial enthusiasm that you got from Star Trek and Star Wars, yeah?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and I have a feeling that most of my colleagues feel the same way.
You want science to be what science fiction got you excited about it in the...
Well, you know, it's okay to be disappointed from time to time, but it's really nice when something like this happens.
What can we expect? You know, what's the next step in this, in looking into this particular phenomenon, Christoph?
Into this particular system?
Yeah,
or...
the discovery in general of these exoplanets. I mean, where do we go from here?
Right. So we're doing, the astronomical community is, exoplanets have become obviously very popular. And so we're trying to understand these worlds from many different views. So for this particular system, TRAPPIST-1, we're anticipating the launch of the James Webb Space Telescope in hopefully at the end of next year. And what that facility will allow us to do is actually do what's known as transit spectroscopy. So hopefully, if there is an atmosphere on these worlds, we'll actually be able to measure it, and we'll be able to say something more about the chemistry of these planets.
And when that happens, Christoph, we're going to want to check in with you.
Oh, absolutely.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Oh, sure.
Christoph Baranek is a faculty member with the University of Hawaii's Institute for Astronomy. His specialty is building adaptive optics systems that allow us to directly see exoplanets and to confirm the sizes of exoplanets from projects such as the one he alluded to, NASA's Kepler mission. There's always a variety of activities going on throughout the state, more than we're able to keep track of, but Morning Edition host and colleague Derek Alama is able to help us out with that, joining us for a look at events going on in our community that might be considered under the radar. Good morning. Good day, I should say.
Good day, and aloha to you, Chris, yes.
Aloha always works, doesn't it?
Under the radar for Tuesday on Oahu, Linda Pike Moriarty is the author of the book Ni'ihau Shell Lays, and she'll share her knowledge and long experience of working with these unique shell lays produced only on Ni'ihau. And this talk is in the multipurpose room of the Hawaii State Art Museum downtown. That's tomorrow at noon. And hopefully she'll bring some lays with her.
I was hoping, yeah. I mean, because they really are spectacular.
Yes, very special. Bring a lunch to eat during the lecture, and it's free. If you heard the Hokulea report on Morning Edition today, you know that the canoe is en route to Rapa Nui, Easter Island. And you can talk a person who has had firsthand experience of the voyage, crew member and apprentice navigator Brad Ka'aleleo Wong, will share his experiences on the Malama Honua worldwide voyage and talk about the importance to take care of island Earth.
And from his perspective, he really... see a lot of that, can't he?
Oh, yes. I mean, Brad recently returned from the voyage leg, which went from Key West, Florida, to the Panama Canal and back to the Pacific. And this talk is happening at 3 p.m. in Windward Community College's Hale La'akea Executive Conference Room, and it's free.
Terrific. And on the Big Island, what's cooking?
Oh, okay. The Kailua Kona Library invites you to listen to the stories of celebrated landscapes of North Kona. Storyteller Ku'ule Kea Kealani We'll talk about everything you need to know about those landscapes. The program is free to the public tomorrow at 4:30.
Thanks, Derek. Some really good free stuff to do. Mm-hmm. Appreciate
it. Sure.
Derek Malama joins us to take a closer look at events in our community that might be going on under the radar. And you can always find out more about those at our website at hawaiipublicradio.org. Awful lot of talk about the Oscars last night just because we expect it to be such a well-oiled machine, don't we?
Oh, bringing us back to the top of the program. And, yeah. And frankly, every program, I mean, this morning early on Morning Edition, they were talking about
it. It's really
it.
Caught everybody.
Many of the other shows, yeah. too. Probably because it's not happened before.
Well, because we expect our well-oiled machines to operate as well-oiled machines.
Yeah, especially at Price Waterhouse.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, when you think of, I mean, we managed to get this show on the air with our little group of four people, and most of the time I get your name right and you get mine. So I guess we can pat ourselves on the back for that.
I guess that's a very good thing, but maybe if we were standing up there in front of so many people there in the studio, not the studio, but in the arena, and all those millions of people watching worldwide, it might be so. And also, you know, okay, so Warren Beatty is pushing 80, maybe we should cut him some slack. But, you know, should someone say, hey, this isn't right?
Let's hope so.
Oh, well, there's always the next opportunity.
That's right.
Hopefully we won't have one of those, though. But we will have one to come back and talk to you tomorrow. And we're going to take a look at some of the good government bills, what will be crossing over, what survived. Brian Black, the executive director for Civil Beats Law Center for the Public Interest, will be here.
And we'll take a look at the growing role of the artist as activist.
If you've got questions, you can send in those questions to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org or anything else you want to get off your chest. That's the place to send them.
And you can find past shows under Talk Shows for the Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. We'll see you tomorrow for more of The Conversation.